أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
As-salamu alaykum. Peace be unto you. Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. We're continuing today with our series dealing with the sources of Islam. Today we'll have our third program dealing with the topic of the linguistic miracle of the Quran. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining you on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Before we get into the meat of today's program, could you very quickly summarize the main points we touched on in our second discussion of this topic last week?
Certainly. The first thing that indicated that it is impossible to say that the failure of the eloquent Arabs to match the Quran was because of any incidental reason. We also indicated that the fact that the Quran is composed of the same letters and words which were known already in Arabic doesn't mean that it's not a miracle, because the human body is composed also of minerals which is in the earth, and what a big difference. Thirdly, we indicated that it is true that each writer has its own style of writing, but we said that the Quran did not ask them to produce something of identical style to the Quran, but anything that is even comparable using the various criteria of eloquence. It was also indicated that we cannot say that, for example, it's possible for the same writers to have two different and drastically different styles. So we said that we cannot say, for example, that the Quran is one style and the prophetic saying is another style, and both emanated from the Prophet, and we analyzed that in some detail to show that this cannot really happen, because the Quran was revealed all of a sudden. It wasn't really out of expectation, so there was no time really to polish. So it's not that big difference, and usually the difference between the styles of the same writers would not be that great or drastic as we see between Quran and prophetic saying. And then we started to look briefly into why, or what is the secret in the Quran which made it so captivating, and to the point that its adversaries even called it magic. And indicated that the Quran is unique, and it captivates even sometimes the one who doesn't understand even the language. And the fact that the Quran does not have the same characteristics like poetry, but has the impact of poetry in terms of joy and grace. It has some of the characteristics of prose, but it's not exactly prose. It has rhymes, but it's nothing like the rhymes of the soothsayers or wizards. Nothing like that at all. So we said that these are all even just the surface behind which there are lots of additional issues which show the precision and linguistic, unique linguistic characteristics of the Quran.
Well, could we begin today's program perhaps with an examination of some of these unique linguistic characteristics?
Sure. Well, to start with, perhaps we can, by way of just clarifying one issue, is the combination and balance between precision and expression and comprehensiveness. Let me clarify that a little bit. When you try to express an idea, any writer would have a very difficult dilemma. If you want to express that idea with a great deal of clarity and comprehensiveness, then you've got to use so many words. And sometimes, because you want to really make it clear, you go too far in adding words, many of which might be redundant. Sometimes exaggeration would have to take place. It gets, to some extent, boring, to be boring. And if you try to economize in the usage of words and just, you know, express things in a more concise way, again, sometimes you get to too much precision that the expression becomes dry and does not express the idea with clarity. Okay? And it is quite known that whoever writes something, any writer, no matter how skillful he might be, if you give what he wrote to a good editor, you always start wondering, even if you review what you wrote yourself after a while, you say, well, my goodness, maybe this word should be deleted. Maybe I should elaborate more on this. Maybe I should summarize that a little more. Maybe the structure of that sentence could be improved in this way or that way. Maybe the sequence of those sentences can be changed a little bit to make the idea clearer. That's why you find many critics say that the most eloquent of writers or the best of poets cannot really reach the stage of ultimate or real excellence in everything they wrote. Even in one subject, you say that one writer or poet might write best in this particular subject or subjects, but no one can really have excellence in all subjects. And even if you write in the same subject, some of what you write might be excellent, some might be good, average, there may be even some that's not as good. And the strange thing in the Quran is that throughout the entire Quran, with the variety of topics and subjects that it deals with, all of which are of consistent and excellent quality that cannot be improved upon whatsoever. Dr. Drez suggests a very interesting idea. He said, open the Quran anywhere, randomly, on any page, and put your hand on the page, and just count how many words under your hand. And he said, bring equivalent number of words from the writings, speeches, or poets of the most eloquent of the eloquent, and just compare both texts and see which one of them can be improved upon. And he says, if you really take any writing of any human being, taking this equivalent number of words, you'd say that maybe this could be improved this way, this can be edited that way. In the Quran, he says, if you search the entire Arabic dictionary to find a better word than any of these words in the Quran to express the meaning better and more effectively, you won't find.
Does this mean then that the Quran can only be appreciated by those who are eloquent?
Not necessarily, and that's another aspect of the miraculous nature of the Quran, also something that human beings can't really reach. Why? If you're addressing people who are very educated and highly intelligent and so on, what happened, for example, in academic meetings and among specialists or scientists, you speak to them at their level, and when you speak at their level, your words appear to the outsiders as almost like a mystery, something that they can't really follow. Just sit in any meeting of those, you know, academics, it's beyond your understanding if you're not really in that field. On the other hand, when you want to address people who are perhaps not in the same level of education, just the public, then you've got to talk to them again in a way that they should understand. But if you have both audience at the same time, it's difficult. It's very difficult, tough. Because if you want to address the more educated among the audience, the other public will not be able to follow what you're saying. And if you're gearing your attention to the public, the more educated might feel that you're insulting their intelligence and you're dwelling on the obvious. And that's why people in teaching, for example, or in public life, find it very difficult to try to combine these two, and sometimes you sacrifice a little bit of this for that. Now, in the case of the Quran, we find that in spite of the fact that it discusses so many subjects in so many diverse areas of human life, it gives complete guidance in various aspects of life, but still, the same Quran can be heard by the simple person, the less educated, and still make a great sense of it, understand it very clearly, while the more educated, the scientist, or the eloquent, can also appreciate it without changing the style of the Quran. You might recall, for example, in the previous segment dealing with the scientific miracle of the Quran, or Quran and modern sciences, we gave some examples of this. When the Quran says, for example, that the heavens and earth were, or the heavens were, quote unquote, smoke, a simple person can understand smoke. A scientist might relate it, for example, to the theory that the universe started as a gaseous mass. Yeah. With a very simple expression,
yes,
both can find a great deal of understanding and appreciation without anybody feeling his intelligence insulted or things are difficult for him to follow. So that means that the Quran really has the unique characteristic because it came from the Creator, who is able to address the entire humanity with all their levels of education, all their levels of understanding, without finding it difficult for anyone, and still have the characteristics of moving their feeling and moving, evoking their emotions.
You indicated that earlier that the Quran evokes feelings, very strong feelings in some instances. Does that mean that it addresses the emotional side of the human, or appeals mainly to the human side?
What do you think? Actually, we can regard that as a third aspect of the miracle also of the Quran. Again, the difficulty that we as humans would definitely encounter when we try to satisfy two things at the same time. Now, if you want to address people, for example, to evoke their emotions or to appeal to their feelings, then sometimes you've got to go too far in these emotions. You don't have to be too rational. I mean, the rational element becomes weaker. It's there, but it becomes a bit weaker because you want to evoke emotions. That's why, for example, in poetry, you find that poets go in all kinds of directions, exaggerate, and do not really appeal to the mind as much as they do to the feelings. And that's why, in fact, the Quran indicates that poetry is dangerous because it could be evocation of good feelings. It could also be evocation of evil. Just as you can use poetry to contemplate the creation of God or Allah in the universe, you can use it to encourage people to drink and indulge in all kinds of things. That's why you find, for example, in the Quran, in Surah 26, in passages 2-24 on, it says that those who follow the poets are those who are straying, because those poets keep wandering in all kinds of valleys, and they valid here means all kind of subjects and without any aim. On the other hand, if you want to address people on the intellectual level, if you want to appeal to the rational thinking and understanding, then you'd have to sacrifice a great deal of the emotional appeal. For example, if you go back to the writings of philosophers, you find that the emotional element is very limited. But otherwise, what they talk about is philosophy, argument, and try to rationalize why they hold this particular idea or view and how they defend it. So you have to sacrifice one for the other, at least have imbalance in the degree of emphasis on emotion versus rationality. But the strange thing about the Quran is that you go through the Quran and you find side by side the emphasis on emotions and rationality. Not that one of them is really submerging the other, but there is the proper proportion to really move the individual on the thinking level as well as the feeling level as well.
Well, could you give us an example from the Quran as to how the rational and emotional appeals are combined?
Well, take, for example, an issue which most philosophers have spent a lot of their time and effort to explain, the notion of the existence of Allah, or God, capital G.
Yes.
All right, and the evidence that there's only one and unique creator of this universe. I'm sure many of the viewers are familiar with all kind of dry philosophical arguments that has been presented throughout history. Look at the Quran. For example, in Surah 21, in passage 22, it puts it in a very simple way. لَوْ كَانَ فِيهِمَا آلِهَةٌ إِلَّا اللَّهُ لَفَسَدَتَا فَسُبْحَانَ اللَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَرْشِ عَمَّا يَصِفُونَ. Which means that if there were that is in heavens and on earth other gods beside Allah, there would have been disorder. That is disorder in this universe, in both heavens and earth. But glory be to Allah, the Lord of the throne, for what they attribute to him. Now, in very few words here, we are given a very strong and powerful intellectual, if you want to call it this way, intellectual or rational reason to believe in the existence of the one and only creator of the universe. And if you look at it carefully, it says that if there were other gods, there would have been disorder. For a person who is a scientist, who an ecologist, who is educated perhaps, you can see that quite clearly in terms of the ecological balance in the creation of Allah, in the balance between the earth and the other components of the solar system, in the balance, generally speaking, between the various heavenly bodies, the balance between water and dry land, the balance between oxygen and carbon monoxide and all that. In other words, for a scientist, you can see a treasure of expression here of this unity of the orders and the pattern which is followed on this earth and in the universe at large. And this is a very powerful rational reason, because it shows that if there is that consistency, if there is that tie between all of these elements in creation, then there must be one source of that creation, because if you have two wills, two minds, it would not have that beautiful consistency and harmony. So on the rational level, you can write volumes on the implication of this expression. On the other hand, you find a similar expression, for example, on this, that even if you assume that there is more than one will or one God or one component of God in this universe, then the Quran responds to that, for example, in passage 91 of Surah 23, when it says, مَتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ مِنْ وَلَدٍ وَمَا كَانَ مَعَهُ مِنْ إِلَهِ إِذًا لَذَهَبَ كُلُّ إِلَهٍ بِمَا خَلَقَ وَلَا عَلَى بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ. That is, if there were more than one God, one creator in this universe, then each God would have taken away what he had created, and some would have lorded it over others. Everyone tried to prove superior to the other. And then it continues again, glory be to Allah. Now, in both of these passages, there is a very clear evidence, very clear understanding about the unity or the oneness of the Creator, which can be understood by the simple person as well as by the highly educated person. So there is food for thought. However, the amazing thing about both passages is that besides this rational appeal that we mentioned in the previous question, this rational clear evidence, it appeals also to the heart. For example, the first passage, that is the one quoted in 21:22, it ends by saying, فَسُبْحَانَ رَبِّ الْعَرْشِ عَمَّا يَصِفُونَ. That is, glory be to the Lord of the throne from what they attribute to him. So after you get this conclusion mentally or intellectually, it evokes your feeling. It makes a receptive reader of the Quran almost utters with the Quran, glory be to the Creator from what they attribute to him. The same thing applies to the other verse. In other words, it's a unique combination, not just to speak philosophically, not just to speak emotionally, but to combine both elements and appeal at the same time to the heart and to the mind, and still in due proportion that no human being was ever able to put them in this beautiful harmony.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are two very interesting examples. We know also, however, that the Quran also deals with legal aspects, and generally when we think of legal language, it's customarily quite precise.
Mm-hmm.
What is the style of the Quran when dealing with the law?
Well, let's give an example on this and analyze it. Perhaps that would make the point. That example was given by Dr. Ziaz, who is the basic source of this segment of the program. Take an issue like the law in Islam with respect to the penalty for murder. Okay? That appears, for example, in Surah 2, in passage 188. And when you analyze the contents of it, even though it deals with a legal aspect, you know, what happens when somebody commits premeditated murder. The beginning of the passage in the Quran, it says, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, that is, O you who believe. Notice here, it doesn't say article so-and-so of the law so-and-so. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe. And that is almost like appealing to the heart, evoking the emotions, appealing to people who comply with the will of Allah by their faith. So that's a very powerful beginning to start with. And as if, again, when it talks about iman, or faith in Allah, is to really soften the hearts of both the murderer and the family of the murdered. See, even in this very severe, grief that they are going through. And then you find that the passage goes on to describe the law of equality, that it says the law of equality is prescribed to you in cases of murder. And then it goes on to clarify, you know, that there is capital punishment for the deliberate or premeditated murder. Okay? After indicating the legal part, in the very same passage, you find that it goes again to provide something which is unique to Islamic law, both in content and the way it's expressed also. And that is, only in Islamic law you find that if the family of the deceased, of the murdered person, forgive the murderer, he may be exempt from the capital punishment, which is something unique, really. It solves problem. It makes the person really come back to his senses if he's forgiven by the family of the deceased. And again, sometimes this might be accompanied by some kind of monetary compensation, just to help them weather the difficult period because of the loss of their breadwinner, let's say. So that's why you find, for example, the verse continues, or the passage, فَمَنْ عُفِيَ لَهُ مِنْ أَخِيهِ شَيْءٍ فَاتِّبَاعٌ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَأَدَاءٌ إِلَيْهِ بِإِحْسَانٍ. That is, if a person, or if remission is made by the brother of the slain, and brother here does not mean necessarily just his brother, because all believers in the Quran are regarded as brothers, which means if the one who is responsible, the guardian of the family of the deceased, forgive. If this remission is made by the brother of the slain, then grant any reasonable demand and compensate with handsome gratitude. That's an interesting thing, because while it provides a way out for forgiveness and some degree of financial compensation, it uses very tender terms, min akhi, his brother, which shows again that, all right, even though there was a case of murder, but after all, to appeal to the feeling of the family of the deceased, that it's not just a matter of revenge, that you are all brothers also, that you still have the opportunity to forgive. See? And then the use of the term أَدَاءٌ إِلَيْهِ بِحْسَانٍ, fairness, gratitude. You see, even in that legal language, you're introducing these elements of feelings and compassion, rather than the dry language we are used to in the legal proceedings. And then the verse continues, that ذَلِكَ تَخْفِيفٌ مِنْ رَبِّكُمْ وَرَحْمَةٌ, that this is a concession from your Lord and a mercy unto you. And then it ends with a firm note again, that whoever commits a crime, or whoever exceeds the limits afterwards, then he would have to have a severe or grave punishment. So you see the various shades of meaning, the various appeals that are made, even though you're speaking basically on a law, and a law of even question of blood even. And you see the precision combined with the, you know, the beauty of presentation, even the law.
Indeed. Well, this raises another question. When an expression is precise, it means that it gives only one meaning. However, we often hear of scholars discovering new meanings of the Quran. How does that reconcile with precision?
Well, in fact, you can consider that another aspect also of the miracle of the Quran. Why? If you check the writing of any writers, If the writer is writing in the 7th century or 8th or 12th century, you find that after a few hundred years, you know, it doesn't sound as fresh, or it doesn't sound as relevant, for example, to the style or the expressions we use in a given time. On the other hand, if a person is writing precisely, then it means only one thing. But to say that there could be different meanings to be discovered over hundreds and hundreds of years, and the text is exactly the same, is something that is beyond human capability. If it can be done for a few meanings or a few hundred years or a few years, it cannot just continue for hundreds and hundreds of years in the same kind of validity, even though you have diverse or different, I should say, different angles or meanings, and the text is exactly the same. Dr. Judge explained that very nicely, and he says, for example, if you read a passage in the Quran, you will feel that it is so precise and so clear that the idea presented is so vivid, as if you're seeing pictures in front of you rather than words. It's so clear and vivid. On the other hand, if you come back at some other time to the same passage and read it and really think about it, many times people who think deeply about the meaning of the Quran will be able to see, well, I could see some other meaning here also. The same thing that you read before, and that could repeat so many times. I can say from first-hand experience, that happened to me, it happened to many people who regularly recite the Quran. You know, the same passage with all the clarity gives different shades of meaning. And this is something that definitely is beyond human reach, because like you said before, if you want to be so precise, you express it in such a way that it means only one thing. But to have the same text without editing, without modification, that people find new meanings as time goes on, is something which is quite unique.
Well, does this present any kind of problems with consistency when you read the same passage and it carries or gives, or you come away perhaps with different meanings at different times?
You mean whether those meanings could be contradictory or something?
Yes.
Not really, and that's another interesting aspect of it, because the meanings or the various shades, maybe that term, shades of meaning, that one can see in the very same passage in different times and different places by different people even, is not necessarily contradictory. In fact, it is complementary and corroborative. Just to give you a similitude, a very nice similitude that Dr. Jazz mentioned, he said if you look at a diamond, for example, each side of the diamond might give you a kind of shade of light or some kind of spark.
Yes.
But if you look at the diamond as a whole also, you would be amazed again with the variety of colors. In other words, they're not contradictory. They're all complementary, just like different sides or different angles that you're focusing on. Perhaps that becomes easier when we look into an analysis of one passage that Dr. Vaz mentioned in his book, which is very interesting. In a very concise and very brief passage in the Quran, it ends. Actually, this is the ending of it. It says, for Allah bestows His abundance on whom He will without measure. Without measure. Just take that ending of the passage, without measure. At the beginning, when you look at it, it's so obvious, so clear that God can give bounties to whoever He wishes without measure. So clear, obvious. But if you really look at it, you find that there are five interrelated meanings. And that is still permissible within this miraculous expression of these two words. One, that God gives whoever He wishes without measure, that God does not stop giving for fear that what He has or possesses will not be enough. So without measure could apply to Allah. Secondly, it could be without measure, that means He gives abundantly and generously without measure. Still within the same meaning.
Yes.
Thirdly, it could be without hisab. Hisab also means accountability. That's, again, the difficulty of translation. Hisab means accountability, which means He gives the human without holding him accountable, in this life at least, because He has given him so much, letting the person to make the choice. Fourthly, without account, that is, without expecting again, or without looking into an account, that is, without the person expecting hisab without expecting or predicting that this bounty will give to him. That's the wealth come all of a sudden to a given individual. And fifthly, it could also mean without count, because the bounties of Allah are plenty. You notice here that you get a number of shades of meaning in this single, simple expression, بغير حساب. In two words, all of them are interrelated, all of them fit together, just again like the different shades of life in the same diamond.
A very interesting program, Brother Jamal. We want to thank you for watching. We've exhausted our time for this week. We want to invite you back next week, and we'll continue with our series in discussion of the topic of the linguistic miracle of the Quran. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.